The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. Good evening to those of you watching on YouTube. My name is Jim Podolsky. I'm filling in for Diana this week and next as she's away. So I'm kind of like your substitute teacher. Don't expect to hear the same kind of things that you'd hear from Diana. She didn't give me a topic to talk about tonight. So I thought I would talk about Labor Day and how that relates to Buddhism. If any of you are not from the U.S., Labor Day is a national holiday here in the United States. It started in the late 19th century because of labor unrest, and it was made an official holiday in 1894 by President Grover Cleveland. So I think management and labor still is at odds, maybe not quite as strongly as they were back then, but I think it's still relevant. One of the things that I think has changed over time and has certainly changed in my understanding of Labor Day and what it is that I'm celebrating is that it's not just for trade and labor unions anymore. As important as they are and a big part of the U.S. Economy, I look at labor as this day celebrating all sorts of labor, not just done in factories and in mines, but and in railroads, but in offices, in hospitals, in schools, outdoors at construction sites and agricultural fields, and in the home. There's a lot of labor that goes on in domestic environments. Some of it's paid labor, some of it's unpaid labor, some of it's volunteer. But I think recognizing that labor as being valuable to what keeps our society running, what keeps us fed, which keeps us clothed, which keeps us housed, which attends to our health and our education. So I hope you've all had some chance to reflect on labor and its role today. And then the question is, well, how does that, where's the overlap between Labor Day and Buddhism, or what the Buddha taught? Well, at the core of what the Buddha taught were practices, things that we could do to cultivate living in a way that would lead to greater freedom and greater release from suffering, from greed, delusion, and hatred. And at least in the Theravadan tradition of Buddhism, what's central to the teachings are the Eightfold Path. And just yesterday we started a 9-month series on the Eightfold Path, which is going to start the first factor will be covered next month. Broadly speaking, the Eightfold Path has three groupings. There's one grouping of factors related to cultivating ethics, leading a life that's at the very least harmless, that causes no harm, and also may be beneficial to oneself and others. The second grouping is about the cultivation of mind, that is through doing mindfulness meditation, concentration, developing the ability to have a stable and clear awareness of what's going on. And the third grouping is the wisdom factors of wise view and wise intention. So within that first grouping of leading an ethical life or cultivating an ethical life, there's one element that's about right action or wise action. So following the precepts in a way that leads to not harming yourself or not harming others through the things that you do. The second factor in that grouping is wise speech. That is, speaking in a way that doesn't, at the very least, doesn't cause harm, but also in the best way is beneficial to oneself and to others. And the third factor in that grouping is right livelihood, or wise livelihood. And maybe that's where the overlap between Buddhism and Labor Day is the most obvious. Right livelihood is about, in some ways, is about earning a living or sustaining oneself in the world in a way that's non-harming and is of benefit to oneself and to others. So that said, there's a lot that's been written about the Eightfold Path. There's books and there's talks. There's at least four books that come to mind for me right now. There's one by Bhikkhu Bodhi, one by Bhante Gunaratna. Gil Fronsdale has written a book on the Eightfold Path. Gregory Kramer. And many, many others. So as a result, I'm not going to talk about the Eightfold Path, or I'm not even going to talk about right livelihood. I would encourage you, if that phrase, right livelihood, sparks your interest, that there's many talks on Audio Dharma and Dharma Seed and books to read. So and that points to how do you work, or how do you just live your life? Some people have said, "Well, I'm retired now, so I don't have to worry about right livelihood." But unless you lay in bed all day, you probably go out and do things. And so, how do you spend your time in a way that's beneficial and meaningful? What I want to talk about tonight instead are some practices that I've learned over the years on retreat. And if you'll bear with me, they do relate to labor. Oftentimes, if you've been on retreat, one of the things that the teachers will sometimes say is that mealtime is sort of the entertainment portion of the show. You know, there's a lot of times when you're doing sitting and walking and sitting and walking. And then when you sit down to eat, it's almost always pleasant, and it's an experience that really wakes up all six senses, right? When you're eating, there's taste, there's smell, there's sight, there's, if it's crunchy, it's sound, and also the mind door. You have opinions about what you're eating and so forth. So eating can be a very rich time to practice mindfulness in a way that generally isn't very challenging. I mean, unless they're serving something that you absolutely can't stand, you know, it's mostly a pleasant experience to cultivate mindfulness. And earlier this year, I gave a talk that included a component of how one might cultivate mindfulness through eating. The other practice that isn't taught so much, and I think is, well, it's not taught outside of retreat practice, but I think is useful for everyone, is what you do before you start to eat. And the practice that was taught to me is one that requires a certain degree of imagination, a certain amount of creativity, which is when you look at the food, try to imagine the people that, all the people that were involved in the cultivation of that food. So on retreat, it's vegetarian. So, you know, imagining the people that have tilled the soil, who have planted the seeds, who have watered it, who have weeded it, and then who have harvested it. After it's harvested, it's transported. Some of the food then goes to a place to be processed. So there's all sorts of processing that involves people, human labor, packaging, and going out through a distribution network of trucks and trains and other vehicles to get it closer to you. And then the people in the kitchen, like on retreat, the people in the kitchen oftentimes are other yogis, volunteers, that have prepared the food, cleaned it, served it. And then there's another whole group of people who ensure that the food that you're going to eat is safe, you know, from the moment it's hard, from the moment that it's planted until it gets to you. There's regulations and organizations that labor to make sure that it's highly unlikely that you'll get sick. It's maybe 99.99%. It's not 100%, but I think in my life I've only had food poisoning twice that I know of, which probably was not the case in my grandparents' day or their parents' day. You know, you couldn't be assured that what you were getting to eat wasn't going to make you ill. So those are all, so just imagining all of those people that have been involved in producing your food. Every morning I have oatmeal, steel-cut oats. So I think of the people that grew the oats, that harvested them, they're processed. They go to the store. There's people there that handle them. I provide the labor to cook them. Blueberries come from Canada. The raspberries come from Mexico. The pomegranates come from South America. The walnuts, I think, are from California. The bananas are from Central America. So people in all of these places have labored to produce this food and bring it to me. And so one of the practices that I do, not every single meal, but many, is to just at least briefly think about how this food has been produced and arrived at my table on my plate. And then to add another layer to that, think of all of the people that supported those people, who fed them, who clothed them, who housed them, who educated them, who took care of their health, their family, their community, their friends, coworkers. It's really quite amazing to think about how many people are involved in just a simple bowl of oatmeal in the morning. You might ask, why am I talking about this? Like, well, it's an interesting practice, right? You know, to exercise the imagination, to think about how this food came to be here. But you want to ask, so what? Who cares? Well, I can think of three levels or three ways that that reflection of how your food is produced and arrives to you, that can be beneficial. The first one is that it brings about a recognition and acknowledgement that that you're dependent on many, many people for something just as basic as a meal. I imagine that the people in this room and the people on YouTube probably have at least one meal a day, but there's many people in the world that don't. So, you know, kind of recognizing that those of us that do get to eat at least once a day are doing it with the help of many, many other people. So recognizing that dependence on others, the fact that as much as we might like to think of ourselves as self-sufficient and autonomous, that really at least once a day we're relying on many other people, that we're connected to those other people, and they're relying on us, you know, to feed the economic system. So that just that recognition and acknowledgement of dependence, I think, can have a benefit. Recognizing, seeing more clearly that we're not as maybe independent or autonomous as we think. The second level that comes to my mind is that it's a chance to cultivate gratitude. I have to admit, growing up, gratitude was sort of forced on me by my parents. Like, I had to thank my aunt for getting clothes rather than toys for Christmas. And I looked at it as kind of a social requirement not so much something that was valuable. But as I got older, I found that, you know, actually cultivating gratitude led to greater happiness and a greater sense of contentment. So in this meal reflection, you might imagine feeling gratitude to all of these people that are supporting you nutritionally. I know one of the practices that I took up maybe 10 or more years ago was every time I went into a coffee shop to get a hot chocolate or something, that I'd always leave some tip, but I'd also personally thank the person that made my hot chocolate. I'd always make sure that they heard me say thank you. And at first it was kind of mechanical, and then after a while I found it really started to become much more automatic, that it made me feel happier, and at least some of the time the barista would light up a little bit by being thanked, you know, that this wasn't just another customer making some demand, but that they were actually grateful for their efforts. So this meal reflection practice can be a time to help cultivate gratitude. I know I've read that there are people that keep gratitude journals, that have a journal maybe when they first wake up, or maybe before they go to sleep at night, writing one or two things that they're grateful for. And over time, it's been reported to me, I don't do that myself, but it's been reported to me that they just feel happier. It kind of works against a certain innate tendency of the brain to remember what didn't go right, you know, the sort of the negativity bias that they talk about, that by recognizing that there were things that happened that you're grateful for, that can actually help counteract that bias and actually make you feel a little bit more satisfied, a little bit more content. So if you do this meal reflection whenever it occurs to you to do it, there's an opportunity there for cultivating gratitude that mostly is going to benefit you because you're the one that's seeing it. You might get a chance to stick your head in the kitchen if you're on it's hard. On retreat, you're usually silent, but maybe after the retreat, thanking the cooks, expressing your gratitude for what they've offered you. Certainly at restaurants or cafes, that's an option. Or if you go to somebody's house for a meal, you know, thanking them not just out of a sense of social commitment, but out of a sense of it being beneficial. So, and then the third level is there's a practice that's taught here at IMC, like every evening, they have something called, or every weekday evening, something called the happy hour, which is cultivating one of four practices called Brahma-viharas, and maybe the main one is loving-kindness. So in the loving-kindness practice that's taught all over the world, you often offer phrases of well-wishing to categories of people, to you usually start with people that are easy to wish well for, like mentors, teachers, people that you don't really have any, that mostly you feel very good about. Might be yourself as well. You know, offering phrases of wishing them to be safe, to be happy, to be healthy, and to be peaceful. So there's usually the easy people, the benefactors. Friends are usually a second category that are usually fairly easy to be wish well for, but you might, you know, have a few little sticking points with them from time to time. And then neutral people, people that you don't really know, just wishing well to people that you might see in the airport or in the supermarket. And then difficult people. So that's the way loving kindness is often taught. With this meal reflection, you have people that mostly are going to probably fall in one of the first three categories. You could see them as benefactors, people that are supporting your life in some way. They might be friends. They might be people that you know. And a lot of them might be neutral people, people that you don't really have any direct connection with, but that you can wish them well, you know, that their lives be safe and happy and healthy and peaceful. And you might wonder, well, what good does it do for me to wish them well if they never see me? They have no idea who I am. But it does, it changes you. It changes it, that this loving kindness practice can soften aversion. So, you know, so to repeat the three levels, there's the recognition and acknowledgement of being dependent on other people, cultivation of gratitude, and then also cultivation of loving kindness. So those are three benefits of doing this meal reflection. I had dinner on Saturday night with a friend of mine who I've known from a food group that we formed 20 years ago. And I told this person that I was going to give a talk about meal reflection. And they had actually lived at San Francisco Zen Center for about 8 years. And so they sent me a chant that they do at Zen Center before every meal. So here it's not just a single person doing it in silence, but it's actually the whole group of people sitting in the dining room read this chant. I won't chant it, but I'll read it. We reflect on the effort that brought us this food and consider how it comes to us. We reflect on our virtue and practice and whether we are worthy of this offering. We regard it as essential to keep the mind free from excesses such as greed. We regard this food as good medicine to sustain our life. For the sake of enlightenment, we receive this food. First, this for the three treasures. Next, for the four benefactors. Finally, for the beings in the six realms. May all be equally nourished. So I'll read this one again. You can find this on the San Francisco Zen Center website. We reflect on the effort that brought us this food and consider how it comes to us. We reflect on our virtue and practice and whether we are worthy of this offering. We regard it as essential to keep the mind free from excesses such as greed. We regard this food as good medicine to sustain our life. For the sake of enlightenment, we now receive this food. First, this is for the three treasures. Next, for the four benefactors. Finally, for the beings in the six realms. May all be equally nourished. And this person also gave me another version of this that from Thich Nhat Hanh, who's was a renowned Vietnamese Zen teacher. And it has a somewhat different ring to it. This food is the gift of the whole universe, the earth, the sky, and the work of many beings. May we be mindful and so be worthy of receiving it. May we transform our unskillful states of mind and learn to eat in moderation. May we take only foods that nourish us and prevent illness. May we practice so that all people in the world will have enough to eat. We accept this food that we may realize the path of understanding and love. And I'll read it again. I'm not exactly sure where this is on the web, but probably if you look at Thich Nhat Hanh and Food Blessing, you can find it. This food is the gift of the whole universe, the earth, the sky, and the work of many beings. May we be mindful and so be worthy of receiving it. May we transform our unskillful states of mind and learn to eat in moderation. May we take only foods that nourish us and prevent illness. May we practice so that all people in the world will have enough to eat. We accept this food that we may realize the path of understanding and love. So I felt very happy that this person sent me these two chants. And they also sent me their version. You don't necessarily have to use the exact wordings here, but you might put together one that works for you. What struck me when I read these, not only was it acknowledging that it comes from many beings, but it points to how we eat, how much we eat. You know, that it's like learning to eat in moderation. So oftentimes, I know for myself, oftentimes if I'm really hungry, I just will overeat because it's good food. It's really wonderful. It's nothing really wrong with that, but there is some value in learning to just eat what sustains the body and helps keep the mind clearer than it can be if we overindulge. There's a part in here about food that nourishes us and prevents illness. So eating healthy food, eating food that is nutritious and doesn't negatively impact our immune system. And then finally, particularly in the second one, we accept this food that we may realize the path of understanding and love. So seeing that we can have higher intentions than just having one more meal, that the intention behind eating is so that we can develop understanding and love. understand greater, cultivate greater wisdom. So that's it for me. I really appreciate all of the, I not only appreciate everyone who's makes the food that I eat each day, but I appreciate all of the teachers that I've had that have taught me the values of living wisely, earning a living wisely, eating wisely, and cultivating gratitude and loving kindness. So, thank you all. So, do you have any questions or comments or... Here, why don't you take this microphone? I know it seems crazy, but there actually are a couple of people on the YouTube chat.
Okay. Thank you for the talk. I was just thinking of when you're talking about the mindfulness and the appreciation for the food, how, I was thinking across other religions or cultures, it seems like food is kind of a thing that takes importance and whatnot. And I was thinking of like maybe Native American culture and sort of using all the food that you have. And I know like in Catholicism, and there's certain days where you don't eat certain types of food or whatnot, but it was just interesting how that kind of is found kind of a commonality. Yeah,
thank you. Yeah, those are great observations. I mean, that it isn't just Buddhists that are into this. That, I mean, food is, you know, fundamental to life, and in some ways very fundamental to community and connection. I know one of the things that I enjoyed when my parents were alive were, no matter what was going on in the family, when we sat down together to eat a meal, like for Thanksgiving or Christmas or something, that there was just a sense of happiness and connection that came from that. So, good. Okay. Well, unfortunately, I'm not close to the computer, so I can't tell whether there's any questions in the chat. So I think I'll just end there. Thank you, and may you enjoy the rest of Labor Day.